This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, my name is Dick Dowd, and I'm here with Joanne Albers. We're going to bring you the first hour of the Cincinnati Inquirer on this Friday, May 3rd, 2024. We'll have some, we're going to bring you the business page, the opinion pages, and some great news articles. But we'll start with the first of two articles from the business page, and it's headlined Sam's Club Using Artificial Intelligence to Speed Up Checkout. This is by Grace Tucker of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. One of the newest perks of becoming a Sam's Club member is exiting the store quickly. That's because Sam's Club is introducing a new artificial intelligence feature to speed up customers' experience waiting in line for receipt verification when exiting the store. The technology confirms customers have paid for all items in their carts without requiring an associate to manually check members' purchases upon exiting. Before the new digital tool, customers reportedly experienced wait times for exit greeters to complete receipt reviews. So is Sam's Club a artificial intelligence technology in Ohio locations yet? The retail chain owned by Walmart announced Wednesday that the feature has been integrated in more than 120 Sam's Clubs since unveiling the artificial intelligence concept in January. In a press statement, the company stated it plans to introduce the feature in nearly 600 clubs by the end of the year, including in Ohio locations later this month through early fall, according to a company spokesperson who responded to the Inquirer in locations with the new artificial intelligence tool. And customers are leaving the clubs 23% faster, Sam's Club reported. So how does Sam's Club new artificial intelligence feature work? After a customer checks out at a register or via scan and go, the artificial intelligence tool verifies a payment through a combination of computer vision and digital technology, according to the company, capturing an image of the cart in the exit areas of the store. That way, customers can simply exit after checking out instead of having their purchases reviewed by an exit greeter. And so here's a list of the Sam Club locations in Ohio and Northern Kentucky. And, well, here's a complete list of all the Sam's Clubs location in Ohio and Northern Kentucky. Beaver Creek, 3446 Pentagon Boulevard, Brooklyn, 10250 Brook Park Road, Canton, 4790 Portage Street, Chillicothe, 1270 North Bridge Street, Cincinnati, 815 Klepper Lane, and 5375 North Bend Road, and Columbus, 3950 Morse Road, and 1755 Hilliard Rome Road. Cuyahoga Falls, 1189 Buckholzer Boulevard, and Dayton, 1111 Miamisburg-Centerville Road and 6955 Miller Road. In Dublin, 5870 Sawmill Road, Fairlawn, 3750 West Market Street, Unit J. Lima, 1150 Greeley Chapel Road, Mentor, 5600 Emerald Court, Oakwood Village, 23300 Broadway Avenue, Ontario, 1070 North Lexington Springmill Road, and Reynoldsburg, 2675 Taylor Road, Sandusky, 614 Crossings Road, Sheffield Village, 5225 Cobblestone Road, South Point, 432 Private Drive, Springdale, 800 Kemper Common Circle, St. Clairsville, 50555 Valley Plaza Drive, Toledo, 1300 East Mall Drive, Warren, 1040 Niles, Cortland Road, Southeast, Youngstown, 6361 South Avenue, Zanesville, 3724 North Point Drive, Northern Kentucky, Sam's Club location, Florence, 4949 Houston Road. Joanne?
S&P 500, NASDAQ slide after Fed rate decision. This is by Stephen Culp of Reuters, Dateline, New York. U.S. stocks closed mixed on Wednesday after the Federal Reserve left its key interest rate unchanged, as expected, and indicated that while its next move will likely be a rate cut, continued progress on inflation is not assured. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ ended lower, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average notched a modest gain. The Federal Open Markets Committee concluded its two-day monetary policy meeting with a unanimous decision to let the Fed funds target rate stand at 5.25% to 5.5%. The accompanying statement left the timing of any rate cut in doubt, and federal officials underscored their concern that the first month of 2024 have done little to build the confidence they seek in falling inflation. At the subsequent press conference, Fed Chair Jerome Powell suggested that while the central bank remains focused on bringing inflation back to its 2% target, he noted progress toward that goal and dismissed the notion of an immediate rate hike. Ryan Detrick, chief market strategist at Carson Group in Omaha, said Powell didn't rock the boat very much. He acknowledged that inflation is still a problem, but remained optimistic that it will improve over the coming quarters. Powell said the labor market was normalizing, citing data released on Wednesday showing job openings dropping to a three-year low. First quarter reporting season has breezed past the halfway point, with 310 of the companies in the S&P 500 index having reported. Of those, 77% posted consensus-beating earnings, according to LSEG. Analysts now expect aggregate first quarter S&P 500 earnings growth of 6.6% year over year, a significant improvement over the 5.1 estimate as of April 1, LSEG data showed. Among individual companies, Advanced Micro Devices shed 9% after its disappointing artificial intelligence chip sales forecast, while Super Microcomputer slid 14% following the company's quarterly revenue miss. The weak results pulled the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index 3.5% lower. Amazon.com rose 2.2% on better-than-expected quarterly results as interest in AI helped drive cloud computing growth. Johnson & Johnson advanced 4.6% after it said it will proceed with a proposed $6.48 billion lawsuit settlement over allegations that its baby powder and other talc products caused ovarian cancer. Starbucks tumbled 15.9% after the coffee chain cut its sales forecast as it posted the first drop in same-store sales in nearly 3 years. CVS Health plunged 16.8% after the healthcare company's earnings fell short of consensus and it slashed its annual profit forecast. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 87.37 points or 0.23% to 37,903.29. The S&P 500 lost 17.3 points or 0.34% to 5,018.39. No. And the NASDAQ composite dropped 52.34 points or 0.33% to 15,605.48. Of the 11 major sectors in the S&P 500, energy shares recorded the largest percentage loss, while utilities led the gainers. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners on the NYSE by a 1.38-1 ratio, on NASDAQ a 1.5-1 ratio favored advancers. The S&P 500 posted 12 new 52-week highs and 10 new lows. The NASDAQ Composite recorded 55 new highs and 105 new lows. Brent futures for July fell $2.89, or 3.4%, from where the July contract closed on Tuesday, to settle at $83.44 a barrel on Wednesday. U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude fell $2.93, or 3.6%, to settle at 79% a barrel.
Dick? Claremont commissioners turn their back on an animal shelter as we turn to the opinion page of the Cincinnati Inquirer. It's from this article is from the Your Turn section. It's by Dennis M. Lucan. He's a guest columnist. For almost a year, volunteers at the Claremont County Animal Shelter have been begging and pleading with the Claremont County Commissioners to step up to the plate. The volunteers and staff have requested the commissioners provide them with necessary funds, staff, equipment, and supplies to address the overwhelming problem of the abandoned dog population at the shelter. Earlier this year, a resident in Bethel surrendered 24 dogs. The Claremont County Dog Warden then followed up with a search warrant and seized an additional 34 neglected dogs, along with an assortment of various other animals. The volunteers have devoted thousands of hours to the shelter to provide a love and care for the dogs there. Without the devotion of the volunteers, the shelter could not function, and the situation at the shelter is critical. With 64 kennels filled and a total of 78 dogs on site, they have run out of space. Some of the dogs are living in pop-up crates for 22 hours out of the day. The volunteers and staff decided to take matters into their own hands and solicited the following contributions and donations. Townscapes provided 22 tons of gravel for the shelter for the kennels. A Claremont County resident donated 150 pounds of pet-specific infill for the artificial turf. A Claremont County taxpayer provided a roll of artificial turf. MM Concrete and Remodel provided a plate compactor to compact the gravel that and is providing an additional roll of artificial turf to complete the project. Bezac Landscaping donated 4 yards of mulch. Claremont and Warren County residents have provided an influx of crate donations to offset the shortage of crates. This list can go on and on of contributions from the individuals in the community and the volunteers. On April 6, a group of 13 volunteers from TQL Logistics, along with other volunteers, were responsible for spreading the gravel and mulch at the shelter. The Claremont Dog Warden provided a dingo machine to assist volunteers in the spreading gravel. There were other volunteers who donated and planted flowers at the shelter. Last year, an industrial-sized dryer was donated to the shelter to clean the towels and rags necessary for the proper care of the animals. Almost a year has passed and Claremont County has failed to install the necessary gas line and electrical line to operate the equipment. Volunteers have paid over $350 to outsource the laundry when they were backlogged as a result of the Bethel hoarding investigation. There was over 250 pounds of laundry cleaned at Tide Cleaners in Anderson Township. The volunteers had to take trash bags full of dirty laundry home to handle the volume of laundry. The Claremont County Commissioners have been MIA, which is missing in action. The commissioners have done little or nothing to address the problem and provide the necessary funding, staff, and equipment or supplies for the shelter. The commissioners just keep kicking the can down the road and thinking the problem will go away. The commissioners don't even respond to emails from the community requesting them to address the needs of the shelter. Therefore, I hereby challenge the Claremont County Commissioners to put on old clothing and spend 4 to 8 hours at the shelter with the staff so they can fully understand their problems and needs. Their visit to the shelter should be without the press and photographers to eliminate publicity photo ops. And Dennis M. Lucan lives in Batavia. Joanne?
Time to turn to the letters. And the first one has the headline, "Prosecution of Student Who Assaulted Teacher Wasn't Political." I am glad the Coleraine High School student who assaulted his 60-year-old teacher has taken a guilty plea. He did attack her. She spent 25 days in the hospital and more in rehab, is still learning to walk and talk, all because he vaped and had no other prior criminal record. His lawyer, Clyde Bennett, however, should be questioned as to why he thinks the aggressive prosecution of the teen is happening for political reasons. What does politics have to do with a teacher who devoted almost 30 years of her life to teach students, help them become better people, and certainly did not teach for money? Parentheses, we know teachers are not paid enough. Close parens, question mark. Just as this woman was nearing retirement, finally able to enjoy her future and relax, she instead is trying to find her new normal. Mr. Bennett, how would you feel if some aggressive teen just decided to attack you, put you in a hospital, have you fighting for your life, all because he vaped? Or what if this happened to one of your family members? Would you then believe this teen should not be aggressively prosecuted? And that's the view of Patricia Hull of Mount Washington.
Well, there's a second letter today, and it starts with, "We must take decisive action to prevent more gun deaths. In light of our Catholic faith, we are supporting a new campaign led by Cincinnati area Catholic religious congregations, featuring a billboard on I-75 that says, 'Put the guns down. Nobody is winning. Let peace begin with me.' We realize that a billboard is not enough. Death by suicide, homicide, and mass shootings ravage our communities at rates 26 times higher than the other high-income nations. Troublingly, the leading cause of death of children and teens in the United States is now firearms. Inaction in the face of this epidemic is unacceptable, and we must take decisive action to prevent these deaths from occurring. We are also gravely concerned with gun violence in Ohio and legislation that expands access to guns. In particular, we are concerned about House Bill 51 and its desire to forego complying with any federal gun legislation, as well as Senate Bill 148, which would prevent the government from keeping a list of those who own firearms and prevent financial institutions from distinguishing firearm purchases from general merchandise purchases. For these reasons and more, we are urging lawmakers to vote no on legislation that won't make our communities safer and to support legislation like Senate Bill 164, the Suicide Self-Defense Act. We must prevent more tragedies from occurring and create a world where all people are safe and free." And this is the opinion of Viola Elizondo, associate of the Sisters of Charity of Cincinnati, and Judith Wadowitz, Sister of Charity of Cincinnati. Joanne?
And as we turn to the main news section, as we do on Fridays, we start with today in history. And this one is kind of short today. Today is May 3. On this date in 1937, author Margaret Mitchell received the Pulitzer Prize for her novel, Gone with the Wind. In 1948, in Shelley v. Kramer, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against racially restrictive housing covenants, saying they were not legally enforceable and that if a state tried to enforce one, it would be violating the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In 1948, in U.S. versus Paramount Pictures et al., the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Paramount and other major studios had violated antitrust law. The ruling required studios to sell all films individually instead of in blocks, and it required them to divest themselves of the theater chains they owned. In 1965, the 173rd Airborne Brigade of the U.S. Army was deployed to South Vietnam, becoming the first major U.S. Army ground combat unit involved in the Vietnam War. And in 1979, Conservative Party leader Margaret Thatcher was elected to become Britain's Prime Minister, becoming the first woman to hold the office. She served until 1990. And William Kane of the USA Today Network compiled that list. Dick?
Well, we turn now to the front page of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And the headline in today's Inquirer is Flood Control Too Costly? Communities along Great Miami River balk at proposal for higher property tax assessments. It's by Scott Wortman of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. And while the waters from a catastrophic 1913 flood of the Great Miami River have long receded, the bills to keep it from flooding like that again could soon rise significantly. A proposed property assessment and rate hike has residents, officials, and even a congressman questioning how communities can pay for flood protection and what power certain agencies should have to raise rates. The cities of Hamilton and Middletown, just north of Cincinnati, fear the tax bills could devastate them and discourage new residents or businesses from moving there. It's going to destroy the city, said Hamilton City Councilman Michael Ryan at a public meeting on Monday. That historic flood of over 100 years ago killed more than 300 people and swept away homes, businesses, and bridges along the 160-mile-long river that flows from Logan County south past Middletown, Hamilton, and Cleves into the Ohio River. Residents in 1915 banded together, hired an engineer, and formed the Miami Conservancy District to build and maintain a flood control system that keeps the Great Miami River and its tributaries in check.
Property owners along the Great Miami River and its tributaries pay for those dams and levees with a property tax assessment based on the level of benefit received from the flood protection. 2 months ago, some of the owners of the 47,000 individual properties submerged by the 1913 flood received a shock. They faced hundreds of possibly thousands of dollars starting next year in annual property assessments on their tax bills to pay for flood control. The three-member Conservancy Board of Directors, appointed by a board of judges from each county in the district, recommended for the first time in 12 years a reassessment of the properties based on the new home values. They also recommended fee increases for capital and maintenance. The nine-member Conservancy Court, made up of elected Common Pleas Court judges, will decide this summer what to assess properties. It's the seventh time in the Conservancy's 109-year history that the Conservancy's cost to property owners has been reassessed. For most, the increase wouldn't be astronomical. About 84% of the property owners would pay less than $250 annually, according to Miami Conservancy District statistics. Some, however, would see assessments of $10,000 or even $100,000 annually. One sports complex in Hamilton would see its annual bill go from $8,800 annually to $477,000. It's based on a century-old formula of how much water the 1913 flood covered on each property and the value of the property. The Conservancy calls it an appraisal of benefits because it is meant to assess the benefit property owners receive from the flood controls. Most of the properties affected, 80%, are in Butler and Montgomery counties. The rest are spread among Hamilton, Warren, and Miami counties. Why now? The levees and dams are aging, needing $35 million to $55 million in repairs over the next 8 years, according to Conservancy officials. We are over 100 years old, said Don O'Connor, chief engineer for the Conservancy, in a public meeting Monday. Quote, the amount of work now, the big chunk of that, is the concrete work at the dams. That concrete is over 100 years old. The 55 miles of levees and five major dams the Conservancy maintains have only become more critical as the number of heavy rain events has increased 228 times compared to 80 years ago, said Miami Conservancy General Manager Mary Lynn Lodor. Since the system was constructed in 1922, the dams have held back 2,149 floods, Lodor said. The Conservancy brings in $6.3 million a year while incurring $9 million in expenses, according to Lodor. The Conservancy fills in the gap with reserves and grants, she said, but it is currently operating with a $1.5 million deficit. The new assessments would have brought in $5 million more per year, she said. This is a devastating flood that occurred in 1913, Lodor said, and the system has worked. That system is over 100 years old now.
Leaders grapple with how to pay for flood control. Faced with a huge backlash, the Miami Conservancy District General Manager said she would recommend to the Conservancy three-member board to pause for new assessments. The board will meet on Friday at Hamilton City Hall at 4 p.m. to discuss the matter. Faced with a huge backlash, the Miami Conservancy District General Manager said she would recommend to the Conservancy's three-member board to pause the new assessments. The board will meet on Friday at Hamilton City Hall at 4 p.m. to discuss the matter. In the meantime, leaders hope to figure out a solution for local flood control. Representative Warren Davidson, a Republican from Troy, who represents the people who live along the Great Miami River, in a letter addressed to Governor Mike DeWine in the Ohio General Assembly, asked leaders to review and update the laws related to the state's 20 conservancy districts. Since the assessments were announced late last month, my office has heard countless desperate requests for assistance for what has been described as taxation without representation, Davidson wrote in the letter obtained by the Inquirer from his office. And officials in Middletown and Hamilton suggested spreading the cost among other property owners throughout the watershed. Currently, residents of five counties pay the Conservancy to maintain the five dams and 55 miles of levees on the Great Miami, Hamilton, Butler, Warren, Miami, and Montgomery. The Middletown City Council voted Monday to ask the Conservancy Board to pause any assessment or rate change for 2 years so the General Assembly can figure out a more equitable way to charge people for flood protection. Lawmakers will have a tough time finding a formula many people can agree on, said Benjamin Yoder, Middletown's attorney. In essence, you're getting into property owners' rights, property owners' benefits, and property owners' detriments, Yoder said. There's no simple fix of an easy red line. Joanne?
Red line, okay. Whatever the solution, David Stark wants a promise that the cost for individual properties won't go up thousands of dollars. Stark manages an apartment complex geared toward artists called Art Space Hamilton Lofts in Hamilton. The new assessment by the Conservancy would have taken the amount the ArtSpace pays the conservancy from $1,200 a year to almost $11,000. That would make the affordable apartments for artists less affordable, he said. It would also mean less art being bought and created, threatening Hamilton's burgeoning art scene, Stark said. I can't stress enough how grateful we all are that we're not wet under the flood. Under flood, Stark said, but these rates are so astronomically high, they'll drown us in an unpayable debt. After learning in March what the Conservancy planned, Stark and other Hamiltonians filled public meetings to oppose the increase. They created T-shirts emblazoned with "Keep Hamilton Afloat." Perhaps one of the hardest hit would be the 1.2 million square foot Spooky Nook sports complex, which would see its conservancy bill go from $8,800 a year to $477,000 annually under the proposed assessment. What exactly that would do to the newly opened complex that hosts regional tournaments in basketball, soccer, and other sports, management wasn't sure. It wouldn't be good, said Mike Dollard, chief financial officer for Spooky Nook. He wouldn't speculate what an annual charge of almost $500,000 would do to Spooky Nook, but he's concerned this could scare residents and businesses away. Even this discussion and the possibility that this could happen is, I'll say, is debilitating to development and future development, Dollard said.
And Conservancy will look at other options. Leaders with the Conservancy said they've heard the concerns and will consider other options. Exactly what those options would be, Lodor, the Miami Conservatory Conservancy general manager, wouldn't specify. Lodor said on Friday she'll ask for a pause in the reassessments of the property, but the rate increases, a 1% increase for capital projects and a 0.59 increase in maintenance, will remain. She said the bulk of the large increases were due to large hikes in property taxes, not the rate increases. We want to really look at this with an open mind, but also quickly and expeditiously, Lodor said. It's critical that we make sure that we're able to continue to provide that flood protection to the communities we serve. The Conservancy will decide in July how it wants to fund maintenance and capital projects for next year, Lodor said.
What is a conservancy district? There are 20 conservancies around the state with varying responsibilities and staff. Some don't have any staff. Some are small and just maintain parks and do basic upkeep such as mowing lawns and repairing playground equipment. Others are multi-million dollar a year operations that maintain dams, parks, and hundreds of miles of waterways. There's a conservancy that protects the Mill Creek, Valley Conservancy District. The Mill Creek Conservancy in 2018 considered imposing a property tax assessment for maintenance. After opposition from the public, the fee was never imposed. The Miami Conservancy District, headquartered in Dayton, has a staff of 49 that not only maintains flood protection along the Great Miami River, but also maintains trails and boat ramps and preserves water quality on the river. State law sets out the rules for how conservancy districts operate and are created. Dick?
Well, the second article on the front page of the Inquirer is entitled, "It's Swine Time for Cincinnati Runners." So here's a lowdown on the 26th annual Flying Pig Races. This is by Hadiza Ogwude of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. The best marathon in the country, according to USA Today's 10 Best Readers' Choice Awards, is this weekend. Starting Friday, thousands of runners, walkers, racers, and spectators will take over downtown Cincinnati for the various Flying Pig-related events, from the marathon to the Flying Piglet. Ready to compete in the race or cheer on the brave flying pig participants? Here's everything you need to know. So when is the Flying Pig 2024? The 26th Annual Flying Pig Marathon and PayCor Half Marathon are Sunday, May 5th. The opening ceremony begins at 6:15 a.m., and both the marathon and half marathon start at 6:30 a.m. on Elm Street. The City Dash four-person relay will also begin at 6:30 a.m. on Elm Street, and the Michelob Ultra Victory Party will last from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Smale Riverfront Park. So how to register for the Flying Pig? While the 10K Flying Pig Relay, Flying Fur, and the Skyline Chili 3-Way and 4-Way challenges are sold out, registration is still open for the full marathon, half marathon, 5K, 50 West Mile, Flying Piglet, 26th Mile, and Pig Abilities. You can register during the P&G Health and Fitness Expo on Friday and Saturday, and Flying Pig Marathon, PayCor, half marathon course routes. This year, the marathon will start adjacent to PayCor Stadium. Corrals will be set up along the starting line with the elite runners positioned closest to the starting line. The corrals will be released in increments as judged by race course officials to prevent congestion. This year, runners will cross the Taylor Southgate Bridge into Newport first. The route will then head down Fifth Avenue over the Veterans Memorial Bridge into Covington before turning onto the Clay Wade Bailey Bridge and returning to downtown Cincinnati. The route then goes west on 3rd Street and north along the west side of downtown Cincinnati. Runners follow 7th Street to Gilbert Avenue and then on to Eden Park Drive. The finish line on or finish swine will be at Maring Way along the Ohio River. To view the entire marathon route, visit the Flying Pig's website. The PayCor Half Marathon will race with the marathon group for approximately 9 miles before turning back toward downtown and ending at the marathon finish line. It will also start downtown and dip into Newport and Covington before passing through Eden Park, Woodburn, East Walnut Hills, and Pendleton before ending on Maring Way near Smale Riverfront Park. To view the half marathon's route, visit the Flying Pig's website. And the Flying Pig schedule? Here's the schedule of events centered around the Flying Pig. Friday, May 3rd, P&G's Health and Fitness Expo, noon to 7 p.m. at the Duke Energy Convention Center. 50 West Mile, 7 p.m. at the Riverfront Transit Tunnel. On Saturday, May 4th, Toyota 10K, 7 a.m. on Maring Way. Family Fun Festival, 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Smale Riverfront Park. Queen City Running 5K, 9 a.m. at Maring Way. Flying Pig Mascot Race, 10 a.m. at Smale Riverfront Park. First Watch Flying Piglet, 10 a.m. at Smale Riverfront Park. P&G Health and Fitness Expo, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Duke Energy Convention Center. And Cincinnati Children's Hospital, 26th Mile, 11 a.m. at Freedom Way. And Goodwill Pig Abilities, noon at Freedom Way. The Flying Fur, 1 p.m. at Maring Way. And then on Sunday, May 5th, opening ceremonies at 6:15 a.m. on Elm Street at Freedom Way. Flying Pig Marathon, 6:30 a.m. on Elm Street. PayCor Half Marathon, 6:30 a.m. on Elm Street. City Dash four-person relay, 6:30 a.m. on Elm Street. And Victory Parkway, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Smale Riverfront Park. And how to watch the Flying Pig. Flying Pig encourages all spectators nicknamed Street Squealers to support runners as they complete the race. To help keep runners motivated, you can set up a spectator spot on a hill or more challenging section of the course, cheer, make signs, play music, and have a party with friends and neighbors if a course travels past your area. Do not crowd runners by standing in the street, especially in the earlier miles, as it may cause a backup for runners and make the marathon more difficult. Be sure to stay to cheer on runners in the back of the pack, not just the first few who pass through your area. It's also important to be prepared for the weather, as it may be cool in the morning and warm up by noon. And looking for a flying pig watch party, the following restaurants are offering viewing opportunities with specials and entertainment. And Moorline Lager House opens at 6 a.m. for a breakfast buffet. Brunch service will be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Call or visit its website to make a reservation. And Joe Nuxall Way downtown, Fulton Yards Coffee House and Spirits. Visit Fulton Yards for a special flying pig latte and live music. 3301 Riverside Drive, East End. And Streetside Brewery, located near mile 21.5. Streetside Brewery will open early with live music and food trucks. And Eastern Avenue, East End, Nation Kitchen and Bar. The bank's location will open at 9 a.m. Saturday and Sunday for spectators. It's at 175 Joe Nuxall Way, The Banks. And E&O Kitchen. Both locations will open at 9 a.m. and sell coffee starting at 7:30 a.m. 3520 Banks Road, Hyde Park, and 56 West Freedom Way, The Banks. The Flying Pig website also has a list of party zones offering complimentary snacks and refreshments for spectators. And parking for the Flying Pig. Roads around downtown Cincinnati will close the weekend of the Flying Pig, so be sure to take those into account when looking for parking. It will be busy, and traffic will likely be heavy on Sunday morning of the race, so give yourself ample time for the travel. Find parking, use baggage buses and restrooms, and find your corral. Here are some parking lots and prices if you decide to park near the race. All suggested parking lots are cashless, per the Flying Pig website. And Lot A, 226 Central Avenue, $5. This lot will be staffed for entry from 5 to 10 a.m. Saturday and 4 to 7 a.m. Sunday. And Central Riverfront Garage, 99 East 2nd Street. The entrance is on Race Street, West Pete Rose Way, and Main Street / Joe Nuxall Way. $5 if you arrive between 5 and 10 a.m. Please have a credit card ready and available to use upon entry. And lots on 3rd Street, Central Avenue, and 4th Street near the start and finish, $10 to $15. 330 Central Avenue, 444 West 3rd Street, 325 John Street, 251 Central Avenue, 5th and Plum Intersection, 3rd and Race Intersection, Queen City Square Garage, 319 4th Street, with entrances on 3rd, Sycamore, 4th and Broadway Streets, $15 to $20. Parking lots on Eggleston Avenue, 1.5 miles from the start line, near relay shuttle buses. And parking in Northern Kentucky is also available in Covington and Newport. Joanne?
Here's the local buzz. WCPO anchors Millward and Stiles leaving the station this month. Two Cincinnati TV anchors are moving on. Channel 9 WCPO TV anchors Evan Millward and Jasmine Stiles are departing from the station at the end of May. They both announced via social media Thursday. Millward wrote in an Instagram post, "After 10 years, it's time for me to step away at the end of May. Sometimes you have to seize an opportunity when it's presented. Simply, the changes there came at the right time for me to make a change of my own, my choice to walk away." Millward, an Ohio University alum, joined WCPO in 2014. "What's next? Some rest and reflection," he added. "Here's to kickstarting summer. Much love to each of you." Stiles, a Florida State University graduate who joined the station in January 2022, told the Inquirer that May 24 is her last day on the air. Quote, "After more than a decade of living out my dreams, it's time for a break. When an opportunity came to walk away, I couldn't say no," she posted to Instagram. "I'm hyped to spend more time with my fiancé and plan our wedding. I'm grateful for my time in Cincy, and I'll still be around. What's next? Who knows? Because at the end of the day gotta end." End quote. Millward and Stiles marked the second and third WCPO anchors to announce their departures this week. Kristen Swilley, who has anchored and reported at the station for 9 years, announced on social media Sunday that she will leave in 2 weeks. And Victoria Moorwood compiled that piece. Dick?
Well, Eta Aquarid's meteor shower will give Ohioans another treat this week. It's by Chad Murphy of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. Keep your eyes on the skies. The next celestial show is coming this week, and it's one that won't return for another 20 years. This year has already given Ohioans a total solar eclipse, the possibility of seeing the northern lights, a visit from the Devil Comet and the Lyrid meteor shower. Now, it's time for the Eta Aquarids. Typically, the yearly Eta Aquarid meteor shower would peak from the evening of May 4th to the morning of May 5th, according to NASA. However, this year the show is expected to last from May 2 to May 6th. And why? Because of an outburst. To explain an outburst, you first have to look at what causes meteor showers. Bill Cook of the Meteoroid Environment Office at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, tells NASA Watch the Skies blog that many of the shooting stars this year will be caused by materials from Halley's Comet. As the Earth runs into that debris, it creates streaks of light in the sky. An outburst happens when the planet hits a concentrated clump of that material. The next Eta Aquarid outburst won't happen until 2046. So how to watch the Eta Aquarid meteor shower? With this year's outburst, the Eta Aquarid meteor shower is expected to show about one meteor per minute. Also, the new moon coincides with peak viewing for the meteor shower, according to NASA, meaning there will be less light pollution to block the show. However, you'll need to set an alarm. Peak viewing time is between 4 a.m. and dawn. And what are the Eta Aquarids? Appearing to originate from the constellation Aquarius, the Eta Aquarids peak in early May each year, as previously reported. The meteors are known for their speed, and they can leave glowing trains, which is bits of debris in their wake, that can last for up to a full minute, according to NASA. The meteors originate from Halley's Comet, which returns every 76 years and was last seen in 1986. And after Eta Aquarid's Perseid meteor shower not far behind. The big show every year is the Perseid meteor shower, which this year will peak from August 12th to August 13th with 50 to 100 meteors per hour, according to NASA. Cook says there will be no moonlight to spoil the view of that night, according to the NASA blog. So what are the Perseids? The Perseids appear to originate from the constellation Perseus and are considered to be the best meteor shower of the year, according to NASA. At their peak, the Perseids can generate up to 100 meteors per hour. These meteors originate from comet Swift-Tuttle, which orbits the sun every 133 years and was last seen in 1992. Swift-Tuttle is large with a nucleus measuring 16 miles wide. According to NASA, that's nearly twice the size of the object thought to have caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. Joanne?
Watch falcons incubate their eggs on Downtown Library's live stream. This is by B.B. Hodges of the Inquirer. The birds are back. You can once again get an exclusive look into a family of peregrine falcons via a live stream of a nest box at the Mercantile Library. The Downtown Library installed a camera last year for ornithophiles to watch a pair of peregrines as they raise their eggs to Iasses. This is spelled E-Y-A-S-E-S, Iasses, on the 11th floor ledge. Over 400 subscribers regularly checked on parents Juliet and Albert and their three fledglings, Beecher, Potter, and Taft. Last year's viewers witnessed moments that ranged from heartwarming to tragic. There was the bittersweet time when Albert would make sure to feed the small IS that Juliet neglected. Then there were hard times, like when a fourth egg never hatched. Peregrines tend to return to the same nesting site, but there was some concern the peregrines wouldn't return this year because the Mercantile Library is under construction until this fall. But the loud noises couldn't keep these birds away. Juliet and Albert are back this year, says Mercantile Library's Executive Director John Faraday. The lifelong couple are taking care of four eggs again this spring. Will all four eggs hatch this year? Watch the live stream to find out. What makes peregrine falcons special? Peregrine falcons are the fastest animals on Earth. While diving to catch prey, peregrines can fly faster than 200 miles per hour. Cheetahs, for comparison, reach speeds closer to 75 miles per hour. While the birds may be known for their speed, several traits make them special. They are one of few bird species found on every continent except Antarctica. They also mate for life, so it's no shocker that Juliet and Albert are coupled up again. Peregrines are also considered an indicator species, meaning the health of this species gives us insight to the health of our environment. Are peregrine falcons endangered? The birds of prey were once classified as an endangered species in America. The use of the pesticide DDT during and after World War II severely harmed many species, including peregrines. The falcon's recovery marked the most dramatic success of the Endangered Species Act, and as of 1999, they are no longer considered federally endangered. Dick?
Well, the teachers' union has no confidence in Mount Healthy school leaders. This is by Madeline Mitchell of the Cincinnati Inquirer and the USA Today Network. There was clearly extreme mismanagement of the district's finances along the way, and the people who failed to see the red flags or take any corrective action must be held accountable for that. This is according to Julie Wakefield of the Mount Healthy Teachers Association president. Members of the Mount Healthy Teachers Association issued a vote of no confidence in the district superintendent and school board Tuesday evening. Of the 260 members eligible to vote, 121 teachers voted yes and 14 voted no, according to Julie Wakefield, the union president. Several teachers did not vote. The vote comes after the state placed Mount Healthy City School District on fiscal emergency in April. The district is approaching a projected $10.8 million operating fund deficit and has already notified more than 80 employees that they will be cut after this school year ends. We need answers about how this all went so wrong, Wakefield said in a recent news release. Superintendent Valerie Hawkins is not stepping down at this time. On Wednesday, the district released a statement that Hawkins is deeply committed to the district and to fostering an environment where constructive and respectful dialogue leads to positive outcomes for our schools. And school board president Julie Turner did not respond to the Inquirer's request for comment. District leaders failed to see the red flags in financial reports. Wakefield said the decision to approve a no-confidence vote was not taken lightly, but that teachers have lost trust in the superintendent and the school board. Mount Healthy school leaders should have recognized and responded to the district's increasingly dire financial situation years ago, Wakefield said. There was clearly extreme mismanagement of the district's finances along the way, and the people who failed to see the red flags or take any corrective action must be held accountable for that. The district statement acknowledges these concerns and that the past few months have been challenging for everyone. While the specific concerns cited as the motivation for the vote fall under the purview of the district's treasurer, it is important for all of us to work collaboratively toward solutions, the statement reads. Wakefield said Mount Healthy students are the ones who will suffer most from the deficit and budget cuts. They are losing the expertise and talent of so many dedicated professionals who have given the best of themselves every day to help their students succeed, Wakefield said. We will rise to the challenge to continue to serve them moving forward, but unfortunately, we do not have confidence in the superintendent or the school board to take on this challenge with us. Joanne?
NKU to offer the state's first AI degree program. This is by Madeline Mitchell of the Enquirer. Northern Kentucky University announced Tuesday that it is launching Kentucky's first artificial intelligence degree program this fall. Artificial intelligence is commonly referred to as AI. NKU's program is one of the first in the region. University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College launched an associate degree program in AI this spring. University of Cincinnati offers a master's degree in AI, too, within the university's engineering department. These programs have grown in popularity at other universities in the United States over the last several years. DePaul University in Chicago offers a degree in AI, as well as Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Ohio State University offers an AI summer boot camp. Not long ago, artificial intelligence was just a branch of computer science. It's now above all about communication, how we learn to work with a new kind of non-human intelligence to get our jobs done and to make our world better, said Kevin Kirby, dean of NKU's College of Informatics, in a news release. And we are winding up this hour. This is Joanne Albers with Dick Dowd, wishing you a happy weekend.
Please be safe, especially if you head down to the Flying Pig Marathon.